This is a discussion with six members of a group of 13 students and teachers from Colorado who recently visited Cuba as part of a cultural exchange coordinated with a nonprofit organization called Just Go. The six members discuss insights and tell stories about their visit. It was produced at KBFR.org in Boulder, Colorado, and engineered by ZT. You can learn more about Just Go on the web at www.justgoglobal.org. That's JUSTGOGLOBAL.org.
My name is Heather Gasper, and I live in Boulder, and I work with Just Go, Global Outreach for Students, in Denver. I am the travel advisor, and I was the official chaperone on our trip to Cuba.
My name is Brenna McCoy. I'm a teacher at Thornton High School. I teach Spanish. And I didn't have to chaperone. I was just there for the learning experience.
My name is Loralee Linfield, and I am a student at Fairview High School, and I live in Boulder.
My name is Sam Jambor. I am a student at Boulder High School, and I live in Boulder.
My name is Kelsey Hills Evans. I am a senior at Fairview High School, and I also live in Boulder.
My name is Alexis Gratishar. I am executive director of Just Go Global Outreach for Students, and I live in Denver. And we also had two other students going on the trip with us who were from Monarch High School and from Thornton High School as well.
Okay, so in October of this year, a group of 13 of us traveled to Cuba on a people-to-people exchange. And the exchange was basically to facilitate cultural exploration, really get to know the country, get to know the people. We traveled with Just Go, Global Outreach for Students. And Just Go is a nonprofit organization out of Colorado. And we facilitate international travel abroad for high school students around the area and around the nation. And our trip to Cuba was mainly put together for, like I said, a cultural exchange. And we really had an interesting time going down. We did travel legally. We went through an organization called Cross Cultural Solutions. The U.S. government allows certain organizations around the country a license to take people down on cultural exchanges to Cuba legally. The reason that we went in October was because that license is expiring at the end of December, so legal travel to Cuba will be more difficult after December of this year. And of course there is something out that the Senate is trying to pass right now to open up travel, so it looks like either travel will be completely curtailed or they're going to open it up to the U.S. public, and we just don't know what way it's going to go, but the license will expire as of December. And I think what we wanted to talk a little bit about, to really kind of get into the conversation around Cuba, is our intention for the trip. So, Kelsey, you want to talk about that?
Yeah. On the first night that we were there in Havana, we all discussed our intentions for the trip. Most of us had the intention around education. We wanted the Cuban people to get a different perspective as to how Americans live, how Americans are. And then we also wanted to learn about the Cuban way of life and what it's like to live in a socialist nation and find out the truth behind what Cuba is like. We wanted to find out for ourselves, I think, as opposed to what the United States government has been telling us. We kind of wanted to discover it for ourselves. And I think at the end of the trip, we all succeeded pretty well in accomplishing our intentions.
We went down there, and we were on sort of a guided tour. We had a tour guide. But we had many different appointments, I guess, scheduled with different people throughout Havana and Trinidad, Havana being the capital of Cuba. So we went and we went and spent some time in a junior high school. We went to a medical clinic to see what that was like. We met with
a women's organization, mm-hmm, that provided community service. We met with the Institute for basically International Relations, the institute that is in charge of putting together all the tours, like the one that we were on. So we met with a representative from that institute. So I guess in whole our trip was pretty much geared towards, it had more of a social political agenda set out for us than, I mean, we weren't really on it, like, kind of had our history, but most of it was more politically geared than anything, I would say, just based on who we met and the conversations we had with people.
Yeah, and we experienced a couple different sides of Cuba as well. The agenda that we had was approved by the Cuban government, and so we basically saw what the Cuban government really wanted us to see. They're really very, very proud of their education system, their socialized medicine system. So we saw a lot of that. And then when our agenda was over, we would go out and talk to some of the Cubans who we weren't arranged to talk to. And so it was very interesting to get kind of two sides of the coin and see what the average Cuban thought of living in Cuba.
One of the things that I was most taken by was the Cuban attitudes towards the U.S. embargo. And one thing that I found politically was that the Cuban nationals as a whole were very frustrated with the embargo that the U.S. has on Cuba at the moment, and primarily are saying that they feel that their economic condition is directly affected by the U.S. embargo. And essentially what we saw down there in terms of, you know, you really think about Cuba and what is it like? What do you see? What is the standard of living? I would say that the standard of living is not high. However, I would say that it's not terribly bad either. I've traveled several places in the world, and I've seen the standard of living being a lot worse. Mm-hmm. I would say for the most part, people definitely have the food, clothing, and shelter that they need. There's a 98% literacy rate, so people are very highly educated. In terms of the job market, it's obviously very government-controlled and moving toward tourism. So you saw a lot of, I would say, different ways that the Cuban government was supporting tourism. They were restoring restaurants and making sure that tourists were very comfortable. On the flip side of that, when we actually visited a local hospital, the hospital itself was very run down. Now, I don't know if hospitals in general are very run down, but that right. one particularly was. And so we did get a sense that the money that is going into the government could possibly be going more towards upgrading the touristy type of locations versus the, I would say, the social.
Well, I think that's obvious in what we saw. When we were in the new part of Havana, it looked, in some places, like a slum. Everything was very run down. Buildings were falling apart. And then when we transitioned over into the old colonial part of Havana, where,
which is more touristy.
Right, where the tourists go. I mean, it's where the Spanish built their forts and their old buildings. And that it was immaculate. And there was all this restoration going on and construction going on to preserve the buildings. And so I think that was plainly obvious that their focus right now is making the tourist industry a very successful industry and making those areas where tourists are very presentable and very together, as opposed to focusing on where the Cuban population is generally interacting. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, but despite the standard of living that many Cubans are in, their attitude towards life was absolutely amazing. These people were more optimistic than any American that I have ever met and just enjoyed the basic necessities that they have. They love each other. They love talking to each other. They love talking to foreigners. They love the food, the music, you know, everything that they have, they wholeheartedly enjoy, and really use to the max. And, that was something that I was very, taken by. And I think Americans can most definitely learn from that, just because, especially coming back and just experiencing the culture shock, and how many things we have as Americans, yet how unhappy and almost caged we seem to be, as opposed to the Cubans who have almost nothing and still love it for all that it's worth.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd like to say, I don't know if this is due to the socialist policy down there or whatever, but it seems like everybody there is very community oriented. I mean, we saw it with we had a party thrown for us towards the end of our trip, and everyone, it was just all the homes, it seemed like all the doors were open and everybody was gathered, and it was young people and old people and everyone was dancing and whatnot. And then even in the school we visited, it was the principal and all the teachers were involved in the students' lives, going to their homes, going to make sure that their standard of living was okay. Very just nesting or community-oriented in a sense, where I think we lack maybe that in the United States, but it was just something that was very striking to me, I think, at least.
I thought it would be more of a shock going to Cuba and seeing the standard of living and the cultural differences between there and here. But for me, it was actually a bigger shock to come back and see all that we have here. And just what Kelsey was saying about how kind of unappreciative and unhappy Americans are in comparison with Cubans. And it was more of a shock coming back and seeing all that we have here in comparison to going there and experiencing what they have. It just seems that they live day by day just kind of working towards their basic necessities, and they're very happy with what they have. And here it seems like we've accumulated so much that we don't worry about our, you know, basic needs and fulfilling those. And so we get kind of caught up in these unnecessary tangents.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. In traveling to foreign countries, we oftentimes learn more and more about our native country. I learned a lot about the United States. I learned both the problems that I think the United States faces as far as taking things for granted and not really appreciating struggle and how far we've come and what we have. But at the same time, we have this amazing freedom of choice that really is not enjoyed by, I think, a majority of the world, because of economic reasons or because the government doesn't allow you to decide things for yourself. And coming back home, that's something that I definitely had an appreciation for, being able to decide what I wanted to do, decide
where you want to work,
right,
instead of being told where to work.
Exactly. Decide where I want to work, decide to work, you know, to try to work harder to get to a new level. Just basic things that I think Americans oftentimes don't think about. I really started to think about, because it's not a reality in other parts of the world.
I wish I could remember, I don't know if we'll be able to remember this, but we had a tour guide, his name was Abel, and he was very interested in helping us to see maybe how Cubans live and helping us to learn about Cuba. He was very articulate in English and whatnot. Anyhow, we had asked him, Abel, what are three things that you wish that you could change or that you could have in Cuba that you don't have? And I remember the first thing he said. I'm not sure if you guys will remember the other two. The first thing he said was, I wish we could have a channel on the television that was devoted to religion, in a sense where he could see something one day that was about Catholicism and one day about maybe, you know, Buddhism, and so that people could see the different religions that were out there and they would be free to kind of choose or like one over the other. And I thought that was very interesting, because that's something that we definitely take for granted, just the concept of TV and the million, you know, channels we have. And here
they have two.
Yeah, and all he wanted was just something that gave them a choice about what religion. What was the religious previous to what, like the mid-90s?
Well, they weren't 1996.
Well, I mean, when the Spanish colonized, Spain is a Catholic country, so Catholicism was their initial. But there's also a huge African influence as far as religion goes. And then there seems to be a large portion of the population that claims no religion, which is, I believe, a piece of communism, is that communism comes without religious ties. And so I know there is, I remember him saying that there was a Catholic population, but they weren't very big. Which is very interesting, because most Latin American countries are very, very Catholic, or at least Christian religion. And so there was that tension in Cuba that there isn't in other places in the world, but I don't know.
Didn't Castro not allow them to have religion until, like, really recently.
Previous to 1996, he didn't allow any religious practice to go on.
And so now, I mean, I think they're much happier, but it's still not encouraged.
I would say that one of the things that we were really focusing on was, and I saw a lot of people, we had 13 people in our group. We had five students and eight adults. And a lot of people were struggling with what is the truth?
Mm-hmm.
What is the truth about what we're hearing regarding Cuba and the U.S.? And what is the truth about what the Cubans are hearing? And I noticed that our group got a little bit frustrated with that, trying to figure it out, trying to come. Because we went down there and we saw things that we you know, didn't expect to see. When you hear about people who were risking their lives to put themselves on a life raft to you know, to come 90 miles to from Cuba to Miami, you think to yourself, well, this must be a terrible place to live in order to risk your life like that. And quite frankly, when we went down there, I think I can speak for the group in saying that we really didn't experience that it was a terrible place to live. With regard to freedom of speech, it was interesting. I lived in the former Soviet Union throughout the 90s, but was there in 1988. And before communism fell, you got a sense in Russia that people were a little bit paranoid or even scared to talk about different things, to talk about the government, and to voice their opinions. In Cuba, I did not get that sense.
Mm-mm.
I did not get a sense that people were afraid to speak. They did speak highly of Castro. They didn't worship him, per se, and they did have their own opinions, but they spoke highly of him in terms of a powerful socialist leader. Our guide was also telling us that socialism is definitely the government that they adopt, and he believes that communism is almost the utopia that they're going towards, but they would not necessarily consider themselves a communist country. And we also got into different inquiries into what is the real sense of Marxist communism, because we took a look and we really haven't seen Marxist communism. We've seen a lot of dictatorships that have declared themselves communism. So another inquiry into traveling to Cuba was, what is real communism, and what is it that they're actually going after? And in my personal opinion, what I thought of Cuba in terms of the governments that we have out there are, it looked to me like a socialist government with flavors of capitalism, because you definitely saw that they were catering to the tourist economy, and with flavors of dictatorship because of some nuances. For example, people couldn't have satellite television, although they did somewhat secretly. And
well, yeah, we saw a large black market develop,
right?
Which, I mean, is a faction of communism when you can't. I mean, there were the people with the satellite dishes. There were people in Cuba, excuse me, the only people who have access to the internet, who can get on the internet and access information worldwide, are doctors, and even they're moderated as far as what are they accessing, what information are they going after, and they're the only people who have email accounts. And so there's this huge, I mean, there was a lot of people who, any email address that we got pretty much was not the original person's email address. It was a doctor who allowed that person to receive email and then passed it along. So that lack of access to information, that was something that I felt very frustrated by, that, you know, there are only two stations in Cuba on the average person's TV channel, or on their average TV set, and those channels are put out by the government, they're edited by the government, they don't have access to the internet, they don't have access to the outside world. It seems very self-contained, and to me that is an element of dictatorship.
What I also thought was really interesting was when we went to the junior high school, They all the books there were from before
78,
and so that really just shows like the censorship that the government portrayed, you know, that they wouldn't let them see what else was out there in the world.
Really felt that, though. I think we saw a lot there. I think that our trip really consisted of what the Cuban government wanted us to see, and I think the American government does that too. I don't think that we know very much at all about the whole picture, and I think there's really a lot of truths that are unknown still out there. And so I think though we saw a lot there, I still think there's so much that we don't know and that very few people really do know. So
it's such a multifaceted issue that, like you said, I think we only saw one layer in Cuba. We only get one piece of the puzzle here in the United States. And it's an issue that goes back so many years and has so many different levels of controversy. And, you know, I have Cuban-American friends here in the United States, and my friend's mother won't speak about it. She won't talk about her life because to her it was such a horrible experience. So it's a really hard, it's not a simple answer. It's not something that our government and their government can solve independently, I don't believe. I believe there's going to have to be some letting go of past issues. There's going to be some forgiveness on both parts. And then there can be some dialogue, but it's not a simple issue at all. It's not if we lift the embargo, all the problems will magically go away. I think that is the farthest thing from the truth possible. There has to be a lot of other things that have to change first.
Well, I think that one thing that when we were talking and they were talking about their interest in having the embargo lifted, first of all, one thing that's important to know is not only does the embargo affect U.S. products being brought into Cuba, but also any product made with U.S. part. So if you have, say, a Japanese manufacturer who's making a refrigerator and has an American motor, that product can also not be shipped into Cuba. So they're really, really restricted in that way. And one of the thoughts that I had on the trip and senses that I got was, what would it be like to be alienated as a member of the global community? How would that feel? And because the citizens of Cuba are very literate and are very intelligent, they understand that that's actually what's going on to a certain extent, and are extremely frustrated with that concern.
I was going to talk about a part of the embargo that I think is really significant to the Cubans is the medical aspect of it. Like, our tour guide was telling us that aspirin in Cuba costs like three times what it would cost in the United States, and that's something that's really hampering their medical system there, and seeing how poor their medical system there was in proportion, maybe a comparison to like their education system and other things like that. I think the embargo has really taken a toll on their medical system, and that's a really sad thing to see.
Yeah, children in Cuba, I was told by a nurse at the clinic that we went to, she said that Cuban children will die from a fever, from a simple fever, because they have to wait months for aspirin to come from Japan, and oftentimes they don't have enough money to pay for it. And if it could just be shipped 90 miles from Miami, it would cost a lot less, take a lot shorter period of time to travel to Cuba, and ultimately would save many lives. And again, this is what I was told, you know, and I think we were all after the truth, and we all came to the conclusion that there is no absolute truth, and that the Cubans don't know the truth, and the Americans don't know the truth, and we really can't trust everything that we are told, and we really need to make our own conclusions and understand that they are not the absolute end to the issue. I was talking to a Cuban who said something that stuck out in my mind. He said that, "You probably know a lot more about my country than I do, and I probably know a lot more about your country than you do." And I think that's very true. They get a complete other side of America that we might not be exposed to, and vice versa. We understand a lot about Cuba that the Cubans don't really understand. And that became very clear throughout the trip.
The first thing we kind of ran into was we went into our hotel, and there was a wall sort of dedicated to these five men who had been imprisoned by the United States government.
Two of whom are United States citizens, three of whom are Cuban nationals. No, they were citizens. They were born in the United States, yes.
But did they relinquish their citizenship?
I don't know. I didn't get that far. But they were born in the United States. They were United States citizens. This happened in 1998, and it was something that was totally unheard of on the part of the 13 people in our group. We had no idea who these people were. We had no idea what had happened. And through conversations, what we ultimately found out is that these five men
were in Miami on behalf of the Cuban government, and their purpose there was to gain information about supposed terrorist organizations in Miami. And when we say terrorists, I think we can define those. And probably actually some have terrorist bents, others are just anti-Castro. But there's an anti-Castro movement happening in Florida right now that's been happening since they arrived. And there's always plans to depose Castro from power by these people in Miami from southern Florida. And so these five men were there with the purpose of
finding out information.
Finding out,
about
yeah.
how they were going to try to sabotage the government.
Right, exactly.
So not to get too politically into what's happening, this was something that was very prominent
right.
down there. It was billboards, posters everywhere with our five heroes, our five men, you know.
They've been made into martyrs, living martyrs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in jail, some of them serving life sentences. They were caught by the United States government and were charged with espionage. And the two who hold American citizenship were charged with treason, I believe. And it was never anything that made the media in the United States. I mean, I finally met one person in Colorado who knew about it when I said to five guys. And he said that there was a blurb in the Rocky Mountain News that was like three paragraphs long, and it just kind of gave the skeletal outline of what had happened, and that was it. That was all the information that we got here in Colorado. And it was very shocking to see because it was everywhere in Cuba.
Everywhere
we went, in rural communities, in the urban setting, in the schools, in the hospital, there was a poster. It's everywhere. And here in the United States, we had nothing.
I think that's a good leeway into, you know, into propaganda and how much it is used on both sides in order to mm-hmm. put some kind of a spin on, you know, on the nation. And I think one of the reasons that these five men are so publicized throughout Cuba is because it's a very good way for the Cuban government to put some propaganda and some spin on the relationship with the United States and really to raise national commitment towards the U.S. or towards the Cuban government, rather, in terms of promoting the fact that these five men have been persecuted in the U.S. And there are different ways that, you know, we were looking at as U.S. citizens on what propaganda the U.S. government in the past has used to create nationalism in the United States. But it was a very blatant use of propaganda, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting for us to see.
If there's one piece of propaganda that really has stuck in my mind, it would be a billboard, I guess, that we saw driving back from Trinidad to Havana, and it was a picture of Bush, and it said, in English it meant fascist Bush, and it had the face of Bush with a Hitler mustache on, and that was something that's stuck in my mind so vividly just because it's a perfect example of how the government in Cuba has used this propaganda to really influence the people's opinions, and it just really shows how the people's opinions have been affected by the government, and same with people in the United States.
What I would like to, I think, point out too is what we recognized when we were down in Cuba and speaking with the Cuban people, the different encounters we had. It seemed to me like they recognize that our government is maybe has a different opinion or a different agenda than some of the people that obviously that live in the country, and they don't necessarily they're not necessarily anti-American even if they are anti-American government maybe, and they recognize that we're not anti-Cuban citizens. Maybe we some people aren't in favor of Castro, but I thought it was nice to see that they're accepting, it wasn't just we hate Bush or we hate the government, U.S. government, we hate every American. There's an understanding of, well, not everyone has control over what their government's doing, no matter how democratic you are.
I didn't find that there was a lot of bashing going on at all.
No.
We were talking to a lot of different people in a lot of different realms, and I didn't find that anyone was anti anything. I found there was a lot of frustration. That's kind of the tone that I think that they were coming out of, frustration in terms of their own economic situation and frustration in the sense that that they thought that it was brought on by the U.S. And, you know, one of the things that we posed is I thought that our group did a really great job of being able to be very neutral and being able to listen and really comment on and take to heart the things that people were saying. And one thing that we posed to them as a group was basically to take a look at their own situation, and even if the U.S. government is eliciting an embargo, it doesn't help them to become victims of that situation either, in terms of kind of giving up their own drive.
Well, and that seemed to be an issue that they were not very comfortable. I mean, I didn't get the sense that they were willing to address that.
I would agree.
The sense that I got was that this embargo is causing all of the issue, and if the U.S. would just lift the embargo, all of the issues, all the problems that they have would go away. And when you posed that question, I remember that conversation, and she was, the woman who we were speaking to, was not comfortable at all answering that question. She didn't give us an answer. She wasn't willing to state that, yeah, maybe they kind of are lumping all the blame in one place and not, you know, they're not taking any personal responsibility for working on their own situation. So I thought that was the one time where I really felt that the continuity of all the information we got broke down. That was the one time where somebody kind of faltered and went, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how the rest of you saw that, but
that's also all they've been, you know, mm-hmm. educated on. Right. That's what they've been taught. Right. So it's hard for them to differentiate, you know, see the other side when they really haven't had that opportunity. Mm-hmm. I thought something that I thought was really interesting was that the first thing we saw when we went into the school was, well, they welcomed us, like, very generously. They were so welcoming and loving, and I thought that was pretty amazing, because it seems like if we would have had a group of Cuban students, that came to our school, I don't think we would have given it really a second thought at all. Like, they had, like, a little girl dance for us, and then they had a whole class, have conversations with us, and they were just so excited to have us, and it was a really great feeling to be welcomed, and it seems like that we would not have done the same, which I think is sad, but mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting that the way their educational system works, they have teachers, but they also watch, like, standardized videos, so there really isn't a lot of teachers' opinions that get put out there. It's more like all the Cubans have a standardized way of learning, and it's all government approved, and it's really, I think, a narrow view that they get. And they sing about Fidel and Che and a lot of their national heroes every morning, and it just seems like starting at age 5, it's drilled into their heads that, you know, Fidel is kind of a god. They're really only given one view, and I think that is a large contributor to their, like, opinions of the United States and the world around them.
Yeah, we went and visited a 7th grade class. What was interesting to me was we were able to ask them any question we wanted to, and we asked them some questions that put them in a potential position of saying something wrong, saying some opinion that might go against the government or something like that. And I was very surprised that we were just able to ask them any question to a group of 7th graders who, you know, could easily slip up, but none of them, every single one of them, really believed that the Cuban government was an absolute blessing and that everything they had was because of the efforts of the government and Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and all of the other national heroes. And one of the questions that we asked was, if you could eat lunch with Fidel Castro, what would you ask him or what would you say to him? Some of us, I think, were expecting questions like, why can't I be a baseball player? Or, you know, questions like, why don't I have the freedom of choice? Why can't I wear the clothes that, you know, these visitors are wearing? But it was all the children would say things like, I would tell Fidel Castro, thank you so much for your struggle and your undying mm-hmm. love for the people of Cuba and the revolution and just all of this feeling and emotion around the revolution and the freedom that they supposedly experienced because of the actions of the government. And it was crazy to see that these kids were just either reciting it or really did believe it.
Yeah, I remember one of them said, I would ask him, where did he get his strength or where did he get the courage to continue and to, like, I really want to know that. I want to know how he has been able to continue to be such a strong figure, mm-hmm. which I thought was really interesting for a seventh grader, you know? Yeah. So,
another interesting thing, when we went to the school, all of the, there were five high school students who went with this group, one boy and four girls, and all of the girls were blonde. And so we stuck out a lot because I think people could tell that we were foreigners. Many of us had were blonde, and there were not a lot of blonde people in Cuba. Also, our eyes. some of us had blue eyes, and people would just be
Flock.
So, yeah, where did you get your eyes? And all that stuff. And when we went to the middle school, some of the kids said, you look like the girls in the movies and all that stuff, because the only time that they have ever really seen Americans and foreigners or mm-hmm. blonde people were when they went and saw American films. So I thought that was kind of funny.
Mm-hmm. Something else that I was going to add, I guess in deeper contrast to the views that we got from the junior high school, was that as we kind of talked to Cubans that we just kind of met in Havana, one particular that stands out was this boy who was 17, and initially when I asked him what he thought of the government, he just kind of gave the typical answer, like, you know, it's fine, it's great, whatever. And then as I talked more and more to him, I was like, well, what do you really think of the government? And I think just because of his age and his, you know, more experience in the world, you know, getting maybe a little further away from the education system where they constantly are told to kind of like worship the government, he said to me, if I told you what I really thought of the government, I'd be shot. And I thought that was a really interesting piece that maybe on the tour we were presented with was, you know, the people's opinions that the government was great and that's what they wanted us to hear. But kind of off on our little tangents of the trip, you kind of...
Yes. I'm sure people are interested to know, what does it look like down there? You know, what did we experience? What does Havana look like? And one thing that I can say was that it looks like something that has been stopped in time. During the 1950s, before the revolution I believe was in 1959, Havana was the place of quite the heyday. And a lot of partying, a lot of United States citizens went down there to have a good time and vacation and party and this and that. And I believe one of the reasons for the revolution was you had a lot of the intelligentsia and the foreigners who were having a very good time, but the rest of the population was not having a good time and was somewhat suffering, and therefore the revolution took place. But I would say that in general, it really is fascinating to see all of the architecture. It's very dilapidated. It looks very much, I would say very much 1950-ish. In the old part of Havana, old town Havana, as Brenna colonial. Said, it's very colonial and somewhat renovated. And so it's very beautiful. When you walk through the streets at night in old Havana, you can hear the salsa music. There's a lot of salsa music down there, a lot of salsa dancing. We ran into a dancing party in Trinidad, which was really exciting. And so you can really feel the culture and the experience of the kind of the Latino culture down there. So it's still alive and thriving, which I was surprised at. I thought it would be somewhat hampered, but it's definitely still there. You see a lot of 1950s cars. It's an interesting mix of transportation. There are not a lot of 1950s cars that are in very good condition. Some are in not good condition, but just the thought that these cars have been running for the last 45 to 50 years is quite amazing.
Well, and they capitalize on them as a tourist attraction, because Americans go down there and, you know, the 59 Chevys that are tooling around the city for us are like this cool thing to see, because that we can't maintain, we don't maintain them here like that. So they've capitalized on that aspect of them.
But it's also a necessity.
Right. Well, and they're all used as taxis now. Most of the old cars are used as taxis now.
Yeah. And some of the things that we saw, so you have a large Russian influence, Soviet influence, and so you see a lot of the kind of Cold War Khrushchev Soviet buildings, a lot of Soviet cars as well. And then you also see some modern architecture. There are a lot of five-star hotels that are joint ventures, which Canadian-European investment has come down, and they invested 50% foreign, 50% Cuban joint ventures. And so you see a lot of those types of hotels going up, and some European cars as well, new like Fiats and things like that. You do not see any U.S.-made cars. So it's really a mishmash of different periods of architecture, different periods of automobiles, and it's an interesting experience.
The pollution down there is horrible, absolutely horrible. The ocean is filled with trash. The exhaust is just, the air is just thick, partially because it's so humid, but partially because it's just, you're breathing exhaust all the time, and that was something that I noticed, and they said that that is something that is taught in the school system, is environmental safety and ways to live in harmony with the environment, but obviously not a priority. Emissions is not a priority
down
there. Well, they're
pre-catalytic converters, most of the cars, mm-hmm. So...
Yeah, not good. Mm-hmm.
One thing that you didn't see is you didn't see a lot of vandalism. We were very safe throughout the whole trip, so we didn't feel as though there was any danger.
I think one of the most amazing experiences of the whole trip for most of us was when we met with the CDR, which is the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution. And it is pretty much a neighborhood, and there are people appointed, members of this neighborhood are appointed to this committee, and there's a president and someone in charge of activities for the neighborhood, and someone in charge of patrolling the neighborhood to make sure that nothing is happening that would put the revolution in danger, basically patrolling to see if anyone is...
This is in each neighborhood throughout the country.
Right, and the revolution is what they call the government. They still see themselves... They don't call it the socialist government. They don't call it Castro's government. They call it the revolution. So that was kind of an interesting... contrast, where we heard people would say to us, oh yes, because we'd ask, you know, are there people who don't back Castro, and are there people who have anti-Castro sentiment? And, oh, absolutely, there are people who are allowed to believe, but then, Kelsey just said, there were patrols that would patrol the neighborhood to search out activities that were against the revolution, and so those two ideas are kind of contrary, so it kind of tells you that there really isn't a lot of opportunity for independent thought or independent...
I would say independent freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech or to act out. I mean, that's something that we at the United States, we protest, man. We will line up on the Capitol steps and we'll have a parade and we can write bills, and that is not a luxury that they're afforded. They don't... There isn't... I didn't see when we were there any kind of avenue that would allow that kind of political protest or that voicing of your own opinion kind of thing.
So we traveled to this neighborhood and got off of our little tour bus, and there were just Cuban people everywhere. They're from this neighborhood, families and families, just waiting and applauding us as we got off the bus.
They gave us all roses.
All of the children gave us each a rose, and then they kind of did a little introduction to what the CDR was, and then they turned on the music, and we just danced, and they taught us how to salsa dance, and...
Food
everywhere. Oh gosh, food everywhere. And it was very interesting. The language barrier was definitely an issue. There were only two or three people who spoke Spanish in the group, and yet we were still able to communicate and have an absolutely amazing time with these people and not be able to speak directly with them. And it was really just amazing
experience.
Yeah.
I was walking and I was wearing these sandals, and like the tong part of the sandal came out, and so like my shoe was broken, and I was sitting like in the streets like lopsided, and you know, I was standing there trying to fix it, not knowing what to do, and then this one woman took it and she was trying to fix it and she couldn't. She handed it to her husband, and in 2 minutes he came back and it was fixed, and it was just so amazing. you know, I don't speak any Spanish, but I was like, gracias, gracias, you know, and it, you could just see the expressions on each other's face, how, like, thankful they were. And
I just found that we were, you know, welcomed with food and parties and open arms, and it seems like when they come to the United States, we deport them. I just think it's really quite the contrast.
Mm-hmm. We definitely did see tourism down there. You saw a lot of Europeans coming down. We also saw different groups of Americans who were obviously traveling on licensed programs. So there was a lot of buzz of tourism. So I can definitely see how that's going to be something that really springs up in the future. One of the interesting comments that one of our group members made in a meeting with, I think it was the Friendship House, they said, well, you know, do you want a McDonald's or a Gap on every corner? You know, because essentially if we lift the embargo, you're going to get flooded with capitalism. And they said, well, we don't really want that either. And so it was almost like we want what you have, but we don't want what you have. So we were telling them, you know, really be careful what you wish for, because you may just find yourselves completely flooded with capitalism.
With the temptation.
And, you know, right now the Cuban government, I believe, is very interested in resources and financial resources. And so capitalism and a capitalistic economy coming in there is going to be very interesting. So we'll see what happens.
I think that it will be interesting to see what happens when the embargo is lifted, because I truly think it will be at some point. But if they don't embrace capitalism and they don't embrace that way of life, then it'll be interesting to see how they do get money and how they do
negotiate
with the rest of the world. So
yeah, it's a new time for Cuba. The Soviet Union was supporting them for many years, and since the collapse of the Soviet Union, they went through a very difficult period, and now they're really turning to the West to support them economically, and so I think that's why they're feeling quite a crunch from the embargo.
All this talk about Cuba and nothing about Cuban cigars.
Oh, cigars!
You can bring them back legally if you go legally.
Yes.
Yeah, so there's an inquiry about Cuban cigars, and there seems to be some fascination around that in general in our culture. You are allowed to bring $100 worth of Cuban cigars back
or rum
back to the United States legally. And so we all have carried our Cuban cigars over, but it was a fun trip of drinking Cuban mojitos and smoking cigars and listening to salsa music during the evening. We had a lot of fun nights with that. But yeah, so far $100 worth of cigars is what you're allowed to bring back.
That's only if you go legally.
Yeah. So don't go through Canada.
Yeah.
It's bad. Or Mexico.
Okay. I just think to kind of wrap it up that it was probably the best learning experience, at least of my life and so far, and probably for a lot of other people too. And I just really hope that we can keep spreading our knowledge and spreading, you know, all the things that we learned and our opinions and the Cubans' opinions and just, you know, spread love.
Encourage other people maybe to travel there if they can and mm-hmm. Try to see for themselves. I think we went there knowing a little bit about Cuba and kind of the history book fed version of what it was, and then we discovered a little bit more, but in some ways we have more questions now, but that's what learning's all about. And it'd be great if we could reach a couple people and a couple people would be interested in it. And
yeah, on December the 4th, Just Go is hosting an event called Unveiling Cuba. And we are going to be really kind of throwing a party and talking about our experiences and sharing our experiences with the community. So if you are interested in talking to us and hearing what we have to say, doing a little salsa dancing, tasting some Cuban food, it's going to be at the Museum of Outdoor Art on December the 4th at 6:30. And it is by invitation only. The general public is definitely invited.
The way that you can put yourself on the list is by going to www.justgoglobal.org. And you can also find out a little bit more about our organization if you're a high school student, parent, teacher, who's interested in traveling abroad and finding unique experiences.
The end.
You've been listening to a discussion with teachers and students from Just Go who recently visited Cuba. To learn more about Just Go on the web, visit www.justgoglobal.org.